I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A major climate report earlier this year announced we could be experiencing a climate crisis as early as 2040. Wildfires in California and hurricanes in the southeast might suggest we're seeing some effects already. A little closer to home, the prairies of Kansas are renowned for scenic views and a rich ecosystem. As the climate continues to change, will it survive? Today, we'll ask two scientists. Then we travel to a much different climate, dubbed the White Darkness, which has led 17 explorers to their death. We hear about one man's obsession that culminated in a solo journey across the vast landscape that is Antarctica. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Last month, a major report from the UN's Panel on Climate Change painted a far more dire picture of the immediate consequences of climate change than previously thought. The report described a world of wildfires and worsening food shortages. The authors found that if greenhouse gas emissions continue at the current rate, the atmosphere will warm by as much as 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. So here's our question: what impact will all this have here at home, and most specifically on the tall grass prairie out in Kansas? We're about to find out. With us, Mary Knapp is the Kansas State climatologist. Mary, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse Nippert is the lead investigator for the Kansas Prairie Long-Term Ecological Research Program. Jesse, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Steve. Thanks.
Well, Mary, this report, which was issued in October by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was pretty dramatic. As the state climatologist, what did you make of it?
Well, first I should correct, I am the assistant state climatologist or the service climatologist, so let's get that down straight.
Right.
But we're in the process of doing a regional assessment of that, which will be released later in the winter. So that will bring that number down directly to Kansas and the surrounding areas. Because, as we know, the impacts of these changes are not felt uniformly across the area. They're not even felt uniformly across Kansas. So it's important to see and filter that down through the lens as to what might happen here in this state.
You know, Jesse, given this report, maybe the obvious question here is, how concerned are you about the state of the tall grass prairie in Kansas, given climate change, given this report, given everything these days?
Well, yeah, the tall grass prairie is one of the most endangered ecosystems in the world. Hmm. There's been lots of reports that have spoke to the threatened status, you know, comparing it to things like tropical rainforests, et cetera. And one of the things that is interesting is amongst the many threats to this ecosystem, forecast climate changes are another in the long line of threats to this ecosystem. So we've been studying this for about 20 years, you know, in terms of the experiments that are designed at the Kansas Prairie to understand changes in species richness as well as forage production for grazers and then impacts on other communities. So we're concerned.
But why is the tall grass prairie so vulnerable to climate change, Jesse?
Well, the prairie has been most vulnerable to land use change. So a lot of the tall grass prairie was changed into commodity agriculture over the last 100 years. And of the remnants that remained, a lot of times they are unconnected and they're small in nature. And because they exist in these small units on the landscape, they're a little bit more vulnerable to a series of changes, whether that be from humans or climate or other uses on the landscape.
And when you say that the tall grass prairie is endangered, what would the average hiker notice if he or she is out there walking around? Anything?
The most noticeable visual thing that a hiker would see if they were walking around in tall grass prairie is the encroachment of woody species. So one of the most stark things that you would see now that you wouldn't have seen 10 years ago, which you wouldn't have seen 10 years before that, is just how many woody plants now exist on the landscape. So that land use change as a byproduct of a suite of many factors is the most visible thing you see in tall grass prairie here in eastern Kansas is the increase in woody plants.
So if that continues, if this trend continues, what's going to happen to the tallgrass prairie 20 years from now, 50 years from now? Will it still exist?
If that trend continues, and it will no longer be the tallgrass prairie. It'll be the tall shrubland or tall woody woodland or something, but it will no longer be the tallgrass prairie with the advancement of woody species.
That's kind of a concerning statement you just made there.
Yeah, that's why there are so many different groups that are trying to understand this, trying to work on understanding not just the drivers and the causes of this, but the consequences. What are the consequences on carbon storage, on water recycling, on species richness, on forage production for livestock? There's a lot of research that has been going on trying to understand the consequences of this woody encroachment.
Mary, as you look at the long-term trends for the state of Kansas, is there any hope out there in terms of a reversal of this climate increase that was detailed in the UN's report here?
Well, the problem that we're facing here is that we're actually seeing higher rainfall in the eastern parts of the state, which tends to fuel that woody encroachment that might be a problem. The other difficulty is that we're still seeing the swings in climate trends. Climate has been very variable across Kansas since we started recording it, and that has not changed. What has changed has been the timing of some of those rainfall events, where we're getting it earlier and later in the season, where it's not as favorable for grass production, and that can influence, again, the ability for encroachment. So that's kind of the problems that we're facing. It's not necessarily less rainfall, but timing of rainfall.
And is that a direct result of climate change in your view, Mary?
It looks like it, yes, very much that it is. The warming atmosphere holds more moisture, and that makes it more available for rainfall, again, particularly in the eastern part of the state. The question is, will that persist over time? And that's where the uncertainty is. Will we have a very wet period for another 10, 15 years and then go into a dry pattern, which we have historically seen? Dryness is also a feature of our climate. So we could go for very extended drought periods after very wet periods. And that is very similar to what was being seen in California right now.
So just to be clear, though, you're saying we're not experiencing necessarily more rainfall. It's the timing of the rainfall that seems to be the variable here.
No, we are seeing more rainfall, but it is also being shifted in timing, and that can have a detrimental impact. And we can see it just with a perfect example is this fall. We did not get our rains in June and July when grass is most productive. We were getting it in October and November when those grasses have gone into dormancy and can't benefit as directly from those rains.
Jesse, you're nodding your head as Mary's talking here. You've noticed the same thing.
Yeah, sure. I think that Mary really nailed the explanation. These woody species tend to rely on water that's stored in deeper portions of the soil, whereas the grasses, for the most part, use water stored in the more superficial soil layers. So when you alter the timing and basically you allow for that water to reach the woody plants and it doesn't benefit the grasses, it continues to promote this pattern that we're seeing across the landscape.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the future of Kansas's tall grass prairie in the wake of reports about climate change growing more severe, perhaps being more challenging than we thought it once was. Mary, there are some folks out there who might be listening to this who still have grave doubts about whether climate change even exists. I think one of those might be the President of the United States. What would you say to those folks as you look at what's happening in a state like Kansas?
Well, what we're seeing is that there is climate change. You can look at that. A lot of the debate that still going on is, what are the drivers and how can we control those drivers? That's where the debate is really now. And what we're looking at is how are our actions, not just in reducing the global greenhouse gases,
right,
but also other activities that we're doing that impact the environment on in our area. And again, that gets into the fragmentation issue that Jesse was talking about. It gets into land use management. It's not just the greenhouse gases that influence the changing climate. There are land use changes and other factors that also influence it. And so we need to be very cognizant and cautious about those activities and what impact they may have.
When you talk about land use changes, Mary, you're talking about things like what?
Well, you can talk about things like dividing up large areas into smaller areas where you've fragmented the prairies. That makes it less likely that people will actually burn. And burning has been a method of controlling woody species since the prairies formed, even before human activities were there. Lightning was doing the job of starting the fires. So as you carve those prairie areas into, instead of 1,000-acre areas into 250-acre areas, that makes a difference in how that is managed, even if it appears to still be in grass.
You know, Jesse, aren't these areas of tall grass prairie, they're not protected in any way?
Well, the majority...
There's so little of it left.
Yeah, so the majority of the what's remaining of the tall grass prairie exists in the Flint Hills here of eastern Kansas, and the majority of the Flint Hills is in private ownership. That is one of the large cattle-producing regions of the state for grazing. And these private landowners do burn their land. As Mary was noting, this is a system that requires fire. It must burn with some frequency or the woody plants establish. And as the woody plants come in, obviously there's less forage for the cattle and less income for the cattlemen. And so this relationship between private landowners and the management of the prairie is one that exists and has helped support the prairie, you know, over the last 100 years. The issue is as the land gets parsed into smaller and smaller units, as Mary noted, people are less likely to burn. And if they don't burn, then you risk the woody encroachment, as we were talking about. And in addition, these smaller units on the landscape don't burn with the same intensity. It's not as hot of a burn as it used to be. And so with the reduction in that intensity of the fire is a reduction in the success of this management tool for keeping the woody species out.
The future of Kansas's tall grass prairie, that's what we're talking about here in the wake of a report last month from a UN panel that painted a far more dire picture of the immediate consequences of climate change than we had previously thought. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Also, give me some hope here, Jesse. You know, this notion that we are in danger of losing the tall grass prairie, maybe altogether, that's going to scare a lot of people out there who just depend on it for one thing that makes Kansas so special.
Well, there is reason for hope. One of the main things is that there's a lot of people that are passionate about this region and that sort of depend on this region for their livelihood. Kansas, you know, we're a grassland people. This is our heritage, you know, the Flint Hills ecoregion in particular. And there's a lot of fantastic conservation stewards working out there on the landscape. The Nature Conservancy in Kansas and Nebraska and Missouri are fantastic agents for protecting the prairie and working with landowners to find ways to manage the land, to meet your bottom line, but to also provide conservation benefits. So there are some fantastic stewards of the land out there working with landowners to protect this region. There's also several nonprofit groups that are working to acquire pieces of land and then manage it in a way that promotes biodiversity, promotes basically keeping the land in these natural states, groups like the Grassland Heritage Foundation and others.
But if the climate is changing, can these groups ultimately prevail here?
I'd like to be positive about this. I think that this is a diverse system. It's a fairly robust system. Like Mary noted at the beginning, you know, this is a system that's used to dry periods and wet periods and swings in temperatures. Our intercontinental climate is very variable. And I think by having an active management approach, you know, in the short term, over like the several decades, we can, you know, work to keep the land providing a diversity of ecosystem services.
Mary, do you share that optimism?
Yes, I do. I think one of the things is that the grasslands have a great deal of resiliency built into that. And if we are cautious stewards of those resources, we can increase the likelihood that the grasslands will thrive in a changing environment.
You know, one thing I've read, Jesse, is this notion that climate change, one place where the impact is seen most clearly, is the height of the big bluestem grass out there. I mean, legend has it that once upon a time, the tall grass prairies were so tall that a person riding a horse literally could get lost in it. Is that still the case out there?
Yeah, if you're in a lowland area in the Flint Hills, where the lowland areas tend to have quite deep soil, and the flowering stems of big bluestem and Indian grass still can reach 10 feet, that's still something you can experience. But it's very much dependent upon the annual rainfall and the overall the climate history for an individual year, because the tall portion of the grasses would be the flowering stems, and they're not necessarily produced the same way from year to year.
Huh. What again does this mean for cattle, for ranchers, for farmers, in terms of how the change could impact those folks out there?
Well, so they're interested in forage of these highly nutritious warm season grasses that exist through the Flint Hills. And so with changes in reductions or increases in variability in rainfall and or warmer temperatures, you're likely to see lower forage production. And with lower forage production, there's, you know, less food on the landscape for ranchers.
That's got to be a big concern.
Yeah, it is a big concern. The other thing...
Do the ranchers and farmers talk to you about their concerns here?
As I mentioned before, that is happening. And then as well as interactions with the Nature Conservancy.
Mary, chime in here.
Yes, one thing that they're looking at is, again, because these ranchers and land managers are concerned about survivability and sustainability, they're very much into what's happening and what's changing and looking at how, for example, they may reduce stocking rates during dry years to preserve the condition of the prairie, make it more resilient to that drought, and then increase when you get back into a wetter pattern. And again, by being prepared with a drought management plan, for example, they are preparing themselves for those known variability in their grass production. And in doing that and being proactive in that, they can increase the health of the prairie, have less problem with invasive species and other weeds and problems that can come up with an overgrazed area.
You know, Jesse, do these different groups, these interest groups that are all about preserving the tall grass prairie, do they monitor the burns each spring to see who's burning, who's not? Are there maps like that that are available to see what's going on out there?
Well, there are maps that that researchers at both universities at KU and K-State are able to produce that can look at the frequency of burns county by county. So I believe there are county records. There are, I think, other agencies that kind of have a general record. And then individual landowners, of course, keep detailed records of their own lands. But these maps do exist for the Flint Hills and for eastern Kansas, where you can get a sense of the frequency of burning on a broad spatial scale from sort of year to year.
You know, Mary, any of our listeners haven't experienced a burn, that's really kind of one of those quintessential Kansas experiences, isn't it? It's just something that you'll remember for a very long time.
Yes, you will, very much so. One of the things that has changed, though, is the regulations and prescriptions for burning. So one of the iconic images is a fire cresting the hill at night. But when you look at the requirements and regulations, you shouldn't see that because the burn should end before nightfall.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
And why is that?
And that, again, it's the safety of those that are controlling that burn, because as you go into the darkness, you're not as readily able to see any hazards that might be in front of you. And it's less likely to be, it's more likely to be dangerous. So that's part of the issue that comes into play, is the regulations that have to be followed.
Do these things ever get out of control, Jesse?
They can. At the Konza Prairie, we're very careful with how we do it.
And that's so, near Manhattan.
Yeah. And then within the broader Flint Hills, the land managers and the ranchers, they can get away from time to time. But in general, they're very careful stewards of burning.
Tell us about the Konza Prairie.
The Konza
Prairie. It's a great jewel.
Yeah, the Konza Prairie is an experimental landscape. It's a biological field station located about 10 miles south of Manhattan, Kansas. It was set up and it began in the early 1970s. And in the early 1980s, it became part of this long-term ecological research program started by the National Science Foundation. And since then, they've had detailed recordings of data that document changes in plant productivity, populations of insects, birds, small mammals, long-term climate records, nutrient cycling, et cetera.
So and there's detailed records then in terms of the impact that climate change is having on the prairie right out there at the Konza Prairie.
That's right. Freely available, publicly accessible online data that anybody can download and use to, you know, address any of these scientific questions.
In terms of wildlife, in terms of insects, do you know what are some of the biggest changes that the Konza Prairie folks have noted here?
We've seen, you know, with wildlife, you won't be surprised to know there's been boom and bust cycles. So patterns that we see across the landscape is as one population tends to rise, another population tends to fall. We've seen changes in species richness with regards to some populations of insects, only to a few years later to see rebounds. You know, in the bird communities, we've saw drastic reductions in prairie chickens, but at the same time, over the last few years, some of those populations tend to be rising. We've seen other changes in grassland birds as well. In the small mammal communities, what we've seen is a change that shows considerably higher a number of small mammals associated with woody species, which matches the changes in vegetation.
That boom and bust cycle that Jesse is describing, Mary, it sounds like you suggested here this morning that's been going on in Kansas for generations.
Oh, definitely, yes. And we try and make available the historical weather records that help researchers understand those changes in cycles and see what kind of impacts that might be developing. In Kansas, we're very fortunate that we have over 23 locations that have data consistently going back to the 1900 timeframe. So over 100 years worth of data, and that's daily data of temperature, precipitation, and snowfall. The other advantage with our data set is that it spans the entire state. It is not concentrated just in the eastern part of the state. We can find similar numbers for locations like Colby and Hayes across the gradient of the grasslands. And we've talked a lot on this show about the tall grass prairies, but we do have prairie landscapes that go into mid-grass in the Hayes area and short grass as we get out into, say, like the Cimarron grasslands in southwest Kansas.
Just to wrap up here, is there anything the average person out there listening can do to help here?
I think that there's several things. One is just being generally aware, being aware of your landscape, being aware of the changes that are happening in the city around you, whether it's when trees are leafing out in the spring, you know, the timing of when events are happening, like changes are happening all around us, just being generally aware. And if you're passionate about the grasslands, there's many different ways to get involved. There, like we mentioned earlier, there's these conservation agencies, you know, that are always looking for support. And then just being a general, like I said, promoting that general awareness around you.
Go ahead, Mary.
I was going to mention there are two programs that our listeners could join to participate directly in that. One is the CoCoRoS, which is Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. That's a group of volunteers that use a standard rain gauge to report rainfall in their area, because we know it's highly variable. What falls on one side of Kansas City may not be the same as another. Yes. It's very easy to get involved. And the other is the National Phenology Model, and there is a program where you can join that and report what you're seeing in your backyard. That's as far as the what's leafing out timing and things of that. So those are two tools that interested listeners could participate in.
Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. That's Mary Knapp. She's the assistant Kansas State climatologist. We also were joined by Jesse Nippert, who's a lead investigator for the Kansas Prairie Long-Term Ecological Research Program. Thank you both for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with an author who chronicled the story of a solo expedition across Antarctica. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, the worry every parent has when their child gets behind the wheel is compounded for parents of color. An opera tackles the harsh reality of driving while black. You can hear about it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the story of Thanksgiving has become controversial. So what are we telling students about that part of American history? We'll ask the teachers tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. We'll mention the name Shackleton, and the outdoors adventurers among us will recall the great explorer of Antarctica. But he also was much more than that, as perhaps an unparalleled leader of men. Henry Worsley wanted to be just like the great Shackleton, so much so that he would one day attempt to walk across the continent alone in a voyage where reaching the South Pole was something akin to the halfway point. David Grand tells us the story of Worsley's journeys in a new book, The White Darkness. He's been on this show several times talking about his previous books, including The Lost City of Z, Killers of the Flower Moon, and The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. His story, The Old Man and the Gun, has just been made into a motion picture starring Robert Redford. David Grand joins us from the studios of KERA in Dallas. David, welcome back. So nice to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back on the show.
Well, why did Henry Worsley admire Ernest Shackleton so much?
You know, he felt a special connection to Shackleton, who was this early 20th century polar explorer who had tried to reach the South Pole, and he never made it. And then he tried to walk across Antarctica alone, and he didn't make that. But on each of his expeditions, he managed to rescue his parties, and he really did emerge as one of these great leaders. And Worsley felt a special connection to Shackleton because one of his ancestors had actually been a member of a Shackleton expedition.
So no question that Shackleton is admired even today as a great leader of men. Are his methods still studied? Are they still relevant today, David?
Yes, they are. And what's interesting is that in many ways, Shackleton was a failure. As I said, he actually tried to achieve these objectives that he did not succeed on. And most famously, on his trek to walk across Antarctica, his ship, the Endurance, got frozen in the ice and sank. And Shackleton found himself and all his men more than 1,000 miles from the closest island with any habitation. And he somehow miraculously managed to get all his people back. And so even though he was a failure, his methods of leadership and management are studied by executives, they're studied by scientists, they're studied by political strategists, military strategists. There is a whole subgenre of literature today called basically leading like Shackleton.
Huh. So who was Henry Worsley?
So Worsley was really a remarkable figure. He was a polymath. He was an artist, a sculptor. He was a leading historian on polar exploration. He was a revered British Army officer who was served as an officer of the elite commando unit, the SAS. And he was somebody who, more than anything else, deeply admired Shackleton and longed to become a polar explorer, but never knew quite how to do it. And then finally, in 2008, he decided to make an attempt. And what he wanted to do on that expedition was to recreate Shackleton's Nimrod expedition, when Shackleton had tried to reach the South Pole. And so what he was going to do was to walk as far as Shackleton had gotten on his expedition, which was 97 nautical miles from the South Pole, and then from there continue onward.
Is it fair to say that Henry Worsley was obsessed with Shackleton?
Henry Worsley would have used that word himself. So yes, he said it is very easy for passion to tip into obsession. And Worsley had become obsessed with everything Shackleton. He studied him. He went around collecting what he called Shackletonia, which was letters and diaries from Shackleton and members of his crew. And most of all, he emulated Shackleton's methods of leadership as an army officer. Before he set out on his expedition, he tried to lead his soldiers into battle the same way Shackleton did, which was preaching optimism and patience, leading by example, and always stressing that the welfare of his party was the most important thing of all.
I was going to say, he's just the opposite of a leader who browbeat his men. He was something very different than that.
Yes, Shackleton, and this was especially unusual in Shackleton's day, which was that Shackleton ignored the stifling hierarchies of class and military rank. He participated in the same chores. He made all the officers participate in the same chores as the lowest down member of the crew. They all had the same portions of food. And that was something that Worsley also believed in. He ignored those kind of stifling hierarchies that separated leaders from the people they were leading.
You know, at some point, he decides to journey across the continent with two other men. Who were they and what was their goal?
Yeah, well, it was so unusual about that. So Worsley had a distant relative who had been a member of a Shackleton expedition. And so Worsley, in 2008, decided to reenact Shackleton's Nimrod expedition, which I described a little bit, which was Shackleton had tried to get to the South Pole in 1908 to 1909. He got within 97 miles. He didn't make it. He was then forced to turn back. So Worsley teamed up with two other descendants of Shackleton's original crew. One was a man named Will Gow, who was a banker, and was, I think he was 37 at the time. And the other was Henry Adams, who was a shipping lawyer, who was a descendant of the second in command on the Nimrod expedition. And so these three men who might have had exploration in their genes, but had never been explorers before, decide to reenact this journey.
Describe to us how they traveled across the continent, because I think it's hard for people to begin to picture here.
Yeah, so I think for listeners is to try to get a sense of Antarctica, because they're trekking across a place that's more like trekking across Mars than some place in the United States. I mean, Antarctica is, first of all, vast, as we know. It's 5.5 million square acres. It is the windiest continent, with winds blowing as much as 100 miles per hour routinely. It is the coldest continent, with temperatures routinely falling to minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It is also the highest continent in terms of elevation. And there are these constant whiteouts where the wind kicks up the ice and you cannot tell which way is up or down. And there are also crevasses, which are these chasms, these bottomless chasms. One misstep and they would fall into one. And so these are the conditions in which Worsley and his companions are trekking through.
They literally tethered themselves to sleds that contained all their supplies and pulled these sleds, put a rope around their waist, and literally pulled these sleds across the continent.
That's right. They were doing their expeditions unsupported and unaided, which meant that they had to carry all of their supplies on sleds. Each sled weighed about 320 pounds when they set out. It carried their food, carried their tent. They really could only carry because they had to, you know, you could only haul so much. So each man might have one extra pair of underwear, but that was about it for an expedition which was going to last at least 65 days or so. And they have to haul all those supplies. And one of the challenges is it leaves them vulnerable to starvation because you can only carry so many supplies with you.
I'm visiting with David Grand. His new book is The White Darkness, about a solo trek across Antarctica. You know, why do men do what these men did, David? I mean, They suffered so greatly, hour after hour, much less minute after minute, during the course of those 60-some days. Why do it?
Yeah, you know, it is the hardest and most inexplicable phenomenon.
Very hard to answer. And so, but I think one of the things that drove them, and it certainly drove Worsley, was he saw it as this kind of test of character, this kind of great feat of endurance where he'd have to survive upon his own wits. And I also think these quests are inward, that there is a spiritual quality to them.
That's interesting, because you certainly had that sense from reading about this that Worsley had this spiritual connection not only to Shackleton, but to the continent itself.
Yes, he did. He felt this. For him, in some ways, getting closer to Shackleton was a way of getting closer to himself. And on one of his expeditions, Worsley, on his second expedition, he carved into the ice a message which said, "I am the Antarctic," which so kind of brilliantly captured his spirit and his connection to this place that for somebody like me seems like the most dreadful place in the world, and for Worsley's wife seemed like the most dreadful place in the world.
But, you know, I can't help but ask this. I mean, Worsley has these two great kids. He's got a great wife, and yet he risks it all to do what he did. Is there a little narcissism in that that's tossed in the mix here?
Well, I think there is a tension, and I think Worsley was a very devoted father. He was a devoted husband. He, there is in their story a really beautiful love story between him and his wife, but he felt compelled to go to this place that also threatened to take his life. And there is that great tension in these expeditions that they have consequences. He would always tell his wife before he would head on an expedition, he would echo the words that Shackleton had told his wife. He would say, "Better a live donkey than a dead lion."
Yeah, which I thought was so telling in so many ways, too. Yeah. David Grant, again, is my guest. His new book, The White Darkness, we're talking about Henry Worsley, who attempted a great solo trek across Antarctica. And we've talked about this journey that he just made with two other companions. David, they made it, right? They made it to the South Pole.
They did. And what's so interesting is they made it first to the 97-mile mark, and which was the Shackleton's farthest point. And when they get to that point, this place that had kind of lured them to their dreams, that had nearly caused their demise, they look around, and what do they see? Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Just endless ice. Their grail was no more than this kind of geographical data point in the middle of this nothingness. And it's so cold they can barely linger. And then from there they press on to the South Pole. And they, as one of, as Will Gow, who was the banker, who was a direct descendant of Shackleton, said, completing unfinished family business. And Worsley had actually carried Shackleton's compass with him. And when he got to the South Pole, he held it out and let the needle spin to a stop.
That's just amazing. Along the way, they are able to communicate with the outside world. And maybe we should now switch this conversation to the solo journey that Henry Worsley decides to make. Why did he want to go back? He's in his mid-50s at that point. Why does he want to go back and do it all by himself? The danger level absolutely through the roof.
Yeah, it would be his longest, his hardest, his most punishing quest. And he would have to survive entirely on his own wits. But he saw it as a singular test of character, the greatest test of endurance possible. I think he was drawn to this idea where he had always been this leader of others and a really remarkable leader in that realm. But in some ways, being a leader of oneself is the hardest thing and the most challenging thing. You don't have anyone to eyeball you. You don't have to worry about the welfare of others. You really have to survive entirely on your own. And I think that also drew him. And I think Worsley, you know, Shackleton had described hearing those little voices luring him back. And I think Worsley, each time he came back from an expedition, soon after, he'd think he'd settle down, and soon after, he'd begin to hear those little voices again.
That's just amazing. The whole way he's able to communicate with the outside world. Let's listen to a little excerpt here from Henry Worsley, I think early in his solo trek, talking to the world via social media here.
Good evening. So, on the way at last. On the words, I'll go. It's -7 Celsius only, and no wind. It's just the best place on Earth right now.
And that gives you a sense of what he sounded like. How was he communicating with people back in the States and around the world? And why was that so important to him?
So, so each people were consumed with his expedition and they would follow it. And so each evening he carried a satellite phone. He would call a colleague in London and record these audio dispatches. And it was a way for others to kind of follow and for him to update the world about what was happening to him, what the conditions were, how far he was. He really did like to inspire others. He took questions. People would send questions to his website. And even after sometimes 14, 15, 16 hours of trekking, having lost more than 40 pounds, he would patiently answer these questions to what he referred to as young explorers, to these students.
And you couldn't help but wonder how on earth he mustered the energy in those late nights to continue that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, Henry was not an overpowering figure in the sense of, you know, he wasn't, he didn't look like a boxer or a football player or a linebacker. He had more of a cyclist body. He was, didn't have a lot of body fat. He was incredibly lean. But one of the things he really had was just these remarkable mental powers of endurance. And so he would get into that tent exhausted and he would patiently answer those questions, just as the next morning at 5 a.m. after hauling for days, he would get up again and pack up his tent in freezing cold with the winds howling and begin marching again.
But what did he think about as he trekked along all by himself there, even in conditions where he could barely see the skis at the bottom of his feet as he was pulling his sled behind him? What was he thinking about? What was he listening to?
Yeah, so a lot of it is, you almost have to trick your mind to keep going. And he was a painter, he was an artist. So one of the things he would do is paint the whiteness in the landscape for hours on end. He would imagine his children being beside them, sometimes even have conversations. He often imagined Ernest Shackleton with him. He would have conversations with him. He also brought an iPod, and he would listen to various music that he would pick, Eyes on the Prize, which is a very fitting song, to keep him going, and he would hear those lyrics. Sometimes he would recite mantras to himself. One of the unofficial mottos of the SAS, this elite commando unit, was always a little further, always a little further. And Henry, pulling his sled, would repeat those words, always a little further, always a little further.
What's amazing about Antarctica, in many cases, is it isn't like you go around a corner, you round the bend and here's some terrific waterfall or some different vista that you hadn't seen before. This is just a really stark landscape that he's traversing here.
Yeah, I mean, it has a majestic beauty to it. I mean, it's not flat. So you do have kind of these ice formations coming about you. And the surface, what you become is almost an expert in kinds of ice. There's the soft ice, the sludgy ice, which actually they don't like. They like the least because it slows you down if it's too sludgy. There's also the hard ice or the blue ice. It literally turns blue, which is so incredibly hard. It's almost really hard to track. There is sastrugi, which is, it literally looks like a violent ocean suddenly freezes. It's endless waves of ice to the horizon. But that's really all there is. It's these different, you become a connoisseur of ice.
How thick is the ice in some places down there?
Oh, thousands of feet in places.
That's just amazing. So he begins his solo trek, and he's cursed almost from the get-go. The start is not a great one. What happens there?
Yeah, just like in Shackleton's famous endurance expedition, which is what he was recreating. Now Shackleton had when he had set out to hopefully trek across Antarctica, his ship, the Endurance, famously got frozen in the ice and sank. And Shackleton had to rescue his men. Now, when Shackleton was planning that expedition, he was going to do it as part of a large group. Worsley, who was then 55, was doing it alone. He was doing it unsupported and unaided. Nobody had ever done that before. And so his trek began on the Atlantic side of Antarctica, where the Atlantic Ocean is. He would have to traverse all the way to the South Pole, which was about 570 nautical miles.
God, that's incredible.
And then from there, you that's only phase one.
Yeah, that's only the first half of the game. Yeah.
You then have to cross over these mountains, the Transantarctic Mountains, which rise nearly 15,000 feet high, and finally descend to the Ross Ice Shelf, which is the largest floating body of ice. That's on the Pacific side, off of New Zealand side of Antarctica. And everything began to go wrong for Worsley. The winds howled. He was in one whiteout after another. He was pinned down in his tent. He breaks his tooth. And what's so incredible is he just has these powers of endurance. And despite every obstacle he faces, he is continuing onward and staying pretty close to schedule.
Yes, that's amazing too. Okay, is there anything that you can relate the physical challenge he was up against to somebody, you know, who's not down there? What was it like, what he was trying to do in terms of both pulling the sled and walking to the wind? And can you relate it to anything that you've done in your own life?
Absolutely not.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
No, not even close. Now, it's interesting. I, for the Lost City of Z, I trekked through the Amazon for about 2 months. And it's interesting. There are great perils to the Amazon, but in a way, it's almost the polar opposite of exploration. In the Amazon, you're facing almost overstimuli. There's so much diversity of life. There's a million threats of snakes, of mosquitoes. Right. Everywhere you turn, there's something. And in Antarctica, it is desolation. It is just complete desolation and deprivation, and you are completely alone. There's an awesome silence to you. So it really, I mean, I've certainly been to wintry areas, but, you know, that challenge, that environment, again, it's really more like being somewhere else than Earth.
You know, I've only got a few seconds left, but he actually makes it to the South Pole on this solo trek. But he's so determined to preserve the solo nature of what he's attempting to do that he doesn't like spend the night in the base camp that's down in the South Pole. He sort of still sleeps on his own outside, despite the lure of the potential creature comforts that were just very much at hand at that time.
Yeah, so he'd been alone for days, but when you get to the South Pole, there's this U.S. scientific research base, and but because he's doing this solo and unaided, he can't go inside. He can't have a cup of tea. He can't have a nice warm rest. And so he has to pinch his tent in this kind of self-imposed exile. And then, of course, he continues onward. And, you know, he's on the verge of collapse. He's lost more than 40 pounds. Mm. His tooth is broken off. His fingers are almost frostbitten. He can barely put one ski in front of the other. And whenever Worsley was in danger, and he's then in more danger than he'd ever been, he would ask himself, what would Shackleton do?
Yes. David, I got to leave our conversation there. Again, the book is The White Darkness. The author is David Grant, who's written so many great books. David, thanks for the good visit today. I sure appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, medical marijuana will soon be the law of the land in Missouri. What does it mean for the doctors who will be prescribing it? I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.